Welcome to the Happy Market Research Podcast, your favorite place for strategies, stories, and insights from the world of market research. Brought to you by your host, Dan Fleetwood.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Happy Market Research Podcast. I'm here with Mary Hayes from L&E Research, and we're going to have an exciting conversation today around AI and also the human touch into AI as well. So Mary, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm excited to be here.
Awesome. Awesome. So for those that might not know who you are, can you give us a little background and your role, and then we can get the conversation started?
Sure, absolutely. So I am the Product Insights Manager at L&E Research. I run the Product Insights Department here, which really just bridges the gap between our recruiters and the actual research being done. So we partner with the researchers themselves and go from beginning to end to make sure that they get the best quality data as much as possible. And we assist them as little or as much as we need to in that endeavor. So we can kind of provide that full service experience. So we're a fairly new team. We've only been together as a full team for about a year now, but we have just hit the ground running. And it's just been a very exciting part of L&E to be part of the full service research space.
Yeah, that's great. It's an important bridge, right? Because often I find like recruiting and then to insights. And when the recruiting's done, it's like, you need that bridge to help make sure things, you know, are in order. So you definitely are playing an important role. I know that from experience. So
Yeah. It's so important.
Yeah. How did you get your start in research, Mary? I'm curious. I'm always wondering, this is a question that fascinates me. So
yeah. So I feel like everyone in the research space has a very unique pathway into it because in as a whole, I feel like it hasn't been a real academic stronghold as far as classes and majors go until fairly recently. But I'm a gal who loves a good spreadsheet. Anyone can tell you that. I love observing and recording. And as a little girl, I had a spy journal at age 6 to record what was happening in the neighborhood. I was very inspired by Harriet the Spy. And as I got older, I extended that, finding ways to do research to make convincing arguments like, hey, I want to get a cat. And all that fun stuff. But in college, I wrote a research paper for a class that made me realize how much I loved to blend my love of writing, finding concrete data and interpreting that data into a story. But I didn't actually get into the market research industry itself until about 5 years ago. So I was a facility manager at L&E's market research facility in Austin, Texas. And then I hopped around to pretty much every other area of the company and got to experience all aspects of it. So I tried my hand at recruiting and programming. I found myself in marketing to build and grow our panel and fill our studies. And then after that, I worked as a project manager and then headed a sales partnerships program. And now here I am leading the product insights department. And so I finally can actively sink my teeth into the research. And it's been such an awesome ride. And I just love this industry so much.
Yeah, that's great. I love the spy journal. That is like, It just shows that you were a market researcher at a very young age, and you were doing research before you even knew what research was, right?
It's so funny, and it's all very benign things. I was like, my neighbor was walking her dog today. Her dog was wearing a red collar.
Very observant, very observant. That's awesome. That's awesome. So let's dive in here and talk about humans versus AI and data quality. There's no secret. Data quality is a big, big topic right now. But what do you think the balance between AI and human oversight is in data quality? Do you have any feelings on that?
Oh, yeah. So I do think that AI can help us a lot with some of those tedious tasks that don't require a really like nuanced human approach. Things like scrubbing a data set Excel for duplications, formatting it to be more readable, taking out extra spaces, you know, and can also make the data more searchable and accessible to a researcher. So you can really find all of those juicy findings. But it can also help with like a broad layer of protection against fraud, finding patterns in like data to maybe this isn't a genuine response or detect AI writing in general. But I feel like all of that is very skin deep. It's just like this broad little first layer of protection, right? And to really ensure that you have quality data, a human still needs to review all of these findings. Mm-hmm. As good as AI gets, I still do not believe that it will ever be able to really incorporate that human element. A human needs to be the one in the driver's seat to direct and intervene. And while AI can flag like an open-ended response as being possibly AI generated, a human is the one that can actually take a look at the response and make that determination on the quality of the recruit. I mean, we can actually pick up the phone and talk to the person to know that they're real and, you know, how they speak. An AI can't do that for us. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I think that that's an important aspect of it, right? Because AI, I feel like people are at the stage now where it's going to solve all our problems, and it'll help accelerate and maybe help with some of them, but things still need a human touch in my mind. Like if it helps us be more efficient and get to the end goal faster, okay, but a human is still there, right? So what do you think are some of those human touches that AI just can't replace? And I'll tell you one thing that I heard is AI is good, but it doesn't have a soul, right? Like humans have like this soul and this drive, and AI doesn't have that without us, right? At least at this point. I'll caveat that. But what do you think are some of those human touches that AI can't replace?
Sure. Well, I really think the big one is that AI just does not understand the nuance of human communication. Mm-hmm. And everything we do in market research is all about human communication. Communication with your participants, in my opinion, is key to having that good quality data. AI can help you spot someone who maybe said they were a professional mechanic in one survey and like a cardiologist in another, right? Mm-hmm. And disqualify them as fraudulent. Sure. But it could tell you that someone responded in a way in one survey question that's at odds with what they answered in another. But AI cannot be the face that your participants care about to do a good job.
Right.
They need to know that there is somebody behind all of this that's guiding them. And that person's human there's something about the human connection and know you're doing something for humanity. That's important, that when you take that element out and it all just becomes AI, people can tell. They are instantly going to be less engaged because they do not sense that human presence anymore. And they're frankly just not going to care as much about what is being done.
Yeah. Well, you do a lot of recruitment, obviously, and I'm sure people would want to know about the data quality and recruitment. And the one thing is like fraud, like catching fraudsters and bots and just bad actors, I think is one thing. But how does data quality start at recruitment in your mind? What are some of your thoughts there?
Sure. Well, if you don't have the right people in the room, you aren't going to get good data. And you can have AI or someone write as many screeners as you want. But if you aren't looking at the clear objectives of the research and looking at things from a panelist perspective, a layman's perspective, you're not going to find the right people. And you need to be creative. And sometimes that means not having too hard of lines around what you're looking for. Now, mm-hmm. Don't get me wrong, like quotas are important. Segmenting is important. You need to keep things level for scientific sake, for data analysis sake. But sometimes you also need to cast a slightly wider net because you might be surprised by the quality of participants you find on the fringes that a client might actually want to bring in. And you really can only do that with a human coming in and looking at that and looking at things critically instead of just casting a very, very limited net for people. And then that really does come into communication as well.
Yeah, no, that's good. I mean, I think the being too stringent in recruiting is often like a detriment, right? Because you're like, hey, this person is good, but they don't quite fit here. And how many people do you accept that like, actually, this is what we're looking for, even though it doesn't meet the exact screener criteria? Like it happens quite a bit from my recollection. So
it does. And you might have a hard time. Again, you might have a hard time finding who you really need or who you think you need, because maybe those people don't exist as much as in the incidents that you had originally thought. And so then you have to be a little bit more creative. And maybe instead of you're looking at people that are up to age 65, you look at that 66-year-old person who's fits that criteria, rest of that criteria perfectly, mm-hmm. right? And there might be just some caveats you need to make to find the really good people that can still give you really good data.
Yeah, that's interesting. And you talked a little bit about how stress or confusion can show up in data. What does that look like to you, and how do you spot that?
Oh my gosh. So it's going to show up as inconsistencies or too much consistency. You're going to see anything and everything in between. Like, I truly believe that people are good. I believe that most people that participate in in these studies, that they want to do well. And that's just a human nature thing as well. We want to succeed. We want to be told that we're doing the right thing. But you might see like very good being selected at every matrix question, or somebody answering at odds to an answer they provided before. And like I said, I don't think more often than not, these people aren't trying to cheat the system. They are just tired or confused. I mean, if you have 8 matrix questions in a row that have like 8 different lines to select each, that's going to become really repetitive for somebody. It doesn't matter how genuine you are or invested, you're just going to get tired. I mean, it's better to break up question types when you can. But to provide an example not related to how surveys are written, like it could be somebody dropping out or lagging in submitting their data, which then if it's like, I don't know, like a use test and they have to do this for a week and this for a week, that can introduce a lot of noise into data because they're lagging on responding. And communication is so key for this. Access in itself can be a serious barrier for people wanting to be engaged. If taking a survey requires them to download an app they've never used and to create a username and a password that they forget, that on a platform that they can't easily bookmark, I mean, you've already introduced risk. Or if your platform has photo submission limits and submitting photos is a part of your study, you're now introducing more risk for people to drop out or lag in their responses because they're frustrated by not being able to do the simple thing of uploading a photo. So things need to be easy, quick, and clearly communicated.
Yeah, that's good.
I mean, yeah, we're kings and queens of convenience.
Yeah, that's true. And creatures, like, we want to go to the easiest thing, right? And like the hard thing we want to like shy away from. So that makes a ton of sense, especially like these are things that aren't even like, to your point, like survey related. These are things that like you may ask in your survey because you need to get images uploaded or have them download something, but still, the more frustration, I'm sure the quality of answers aren't as good either, right? So it's definitely a balance there.
They'll stop caring. They really will. And then again, that brings me back to that human element. If you can, at any moment, if you can tell, talking to someone like a human instead of a data factory, telling them they're valued and appreciated in all of your communications throughout a study, it could mean explaining to them why their voice is important. Because the more they see the humanity in what they're involved in, the more engaged they will be and willing to do right by you. So any chance you get to inject humanity into communication with a participant should be seized. Like this could be like, you could even include just like a headshot of the researcher or the facility team on a panelist letter, personally calling people when they have issues or completing a survey or something. And that's what I love so much about what we do in my department in L&E is that we are those people, right? Because we recognize the researchers, they don't have time for that. You know?
Yeah.
And then even our recruiters, like, don't even always, or like certain parts of our departments, they're doing what they need to do. So we're really the people that come in to finesse that and create that human connection to draw out that experience from people. Because, I think that's what really keeps people engaged and what makes people want to do power through, even if they do have some frustrations, which honestly, they're inevitable.
Yeah, they come up. I mean, yeah, you're right. You can have like the best survey, the best everything, but inevitably someone will be like frustrated or stressed out, and they just got to like kind of ease them through the process. Things will be okay, especially if they've never done something like this before, right? It can be like a very daunting experience if you've never like gone into a room, done a usability test, done a focus group, done IDI. Like, it can be a challenge. So I definitely understand that.
And then you think about sometimes you have past participation limits, right? You have to find this balance between people that have participated before, people that haven't. And the reality is that people that have participated in studies before, they know what to expect. They're more ready and willing, and they're easier to recruit, and it's a faster recruit. Yep. The more people that you want that are new, you are going to have a less quick recruit because you need to take time to finesse that relationship, to explain to them how the process works as a recruiter. And then the more you're going to be spending through the study just explaining to them how everything goes. So there's pros and cons to everything, but those are things you definitely have to take into consideration.
Yeah, that's good. That's good. Well, you know, we all have challenges and lessons learned. So I would like to dive into this and give the listeners some insights into some lessons that you've experienced. So what's the biggest challenge you faced in research and how did you overcome it? I'm curious about this.
So, okay. Honestly, I've been saying it this whole time. This is just the boiling down of it, because there's not really one specific thing that comes in mind. It's more that the direct clients and data analysts tend to have that disconnect between their detailed scientific research and investigation and the reality of people. Of just like kind of continuing on that strand. Like, honestly, like I said, that's why I love what I do, because we're that connected tissue between the researcher's scientific and analytical mind that needs hard guidelines for data, and then the squishy, malleable, like inconsistencies of the human brain and human experience. So like, we understand both and find ways to guide our clients through those challenges to really connect to the people to get that reliable data. Like you said, it's not as simple as writing a perfect screener. It's a challenge of getting people to see and understand like that this is the reality of a lot of research qual work and quant work. Like, we recognize that the researchers can only focus on so much, and the scientific method doesn't truly need to be a guide, but you really need to overcome sometimes a little bit of that to connect and find that balance. And maybe that means finding a great partner or someone who has a different mind than you to really kind of see the other side of things, and how can we work to get what we need and still have the quality, have the specifications that we need in order right. to make this research sound.
Right. And I think your role is interesting because you have to deal with both internal and external stakeholders, right? So, and both are come with their own challenges, I will say, but you're playing that, like, I like when you said squishy middle. That's like the best way to describe it, I think, because everything just comes together, squishes together, but it all works, right? So what are one or two tips or tricks that you have that like just kind of make it all work, if you have any there?
I think always trying to look at things from a panelist perspective. And that is just, that's just crucial. You need to look at it like, how would this go if I introduced this to my grandmother?
Oh, that's good.
That's a really good one. Or how would this go if I tried to introduce this to a newly 18-year-old in my family? Something like that. You start to look at things from the perspective of other people who are likely going to be taking your survey or participating in the research. Then you can really start to spot all of the fail points, your possible fail points in either communication or just gathering the data in general. And so you really need to account for all of that. Because like I said, you're not going to be able to avoid a lot of it, especially with some of the guidelines you have for research, especially when you're considering these tests that are they have to have a statistical relevance and all of that. So you do have some guidelines there, but the more that you can think of things from a panelist perspective, from a layman's person's perspective, the better and more successful you're going to be. And you're going to be able to satisfy your data needs, and you're going to be able to keep these people engaged so that they can continue to provide good information. And then also spread the word to other people who also might fit within the criteria you need to be more involved.
Yeah, that's good. I think when you're in the research world, you tend to think that everybody knows what you're talking about in the research space. And then you get outside of it and you're like, oh, people really don't know, you know, about much about this. So it is interesting. That's a good point.
The number of times people in my own family are like, what's it you do again?
Yeah.
I could tell you a million times over what market research is and exactly like how advertisements get made, products get made, all sorts of things that we do. But they just like, people just don't understand that world. And so you really do have to explain it. You have to be very, very literal sometimes.
Yeah. It's like Chandler Bing on Friends, right? Nobody really knows what he does, but it's, I kind of feel like that sometimes, you know? Oh, man.
Yeah. Every family reunion, I'm like, okay, here I go. I got to get my talking points again.
Yeah, there you go. It helps with the elevator pitch for sure. Have you ever had a project lead to a surprising or maybe counterintuitive insight? I'm curious. I know you run a lot of projects and
I think this something that I've seen consistently that always just blows my mind is how people often report things counter to what they actually do. People are so bad at knowing themselves, or they don't realize how much they project a version of themselves that they aspire to versus who they actually are. Yeah. They can fill out a survey all day about their behavior, but you won't really know until you watch them. And those are some of my favorite kinds of studies, the ones where people have a survey and then they also submit a video of them doing something that they've reported in the survey. And oh my gosh, it is so funny to me how much people just cannot accurately talk about what they do. And so I think that's something that's so important to keep in mind when you're trying to find a holistic approach to research, that people are really bad at self-reporting, and they do subconsciously project a version of themselves that they might aspire to versus who they actually are. Because they know how it sounds. Once you put it on paper and you're like, oh, you could be like, oh, I'm really lazy. Mm-hmm. I don't want to seem that lazy. I'm just going to say that I actively do this.
Yeah, right.
You might find a little bit more than you asked for when participating. So,
right. No, that's good. And I think one thing that's tough too, just as a human, is like why you do things. So I remember way back in the day, I did a usability test at Microsoft. It was like some new fantasy football thing they were coming out with. And I was out of a research firm then, and they were like, hey, we need people to come in. Can you help out? And I remember I was like, oh, yeah, sure, I'll do it. And then going through and saying, like, I'm clicking on this and then giving a reason why, it's often hard to figure out, like, the reason why. I don't know. I'm just doing it because it seems like the best thing to do or the one thing I want to do. So it is very hard.
So much is subconscious. So much of what we do is subconscious. And there doesn't seem to be an active reason that pops up in our mind. But even that is important information that, hey, this is something that people just automatically do.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, this is, I want to ask you something that is something that I really like to hear from people on the show. And what's one thing market researchers often get wrong, and how can they improve?
I would say more often than not, I find people pushing timelines in really, really unrealistic ways. And I get it. The research space, and specifically, I deal a lot with product development studies. And the product development space is very limited. You usually have a very specific set of time that you're working with. You might be working years in advance of a product being developed. So you have to get through this stage in this amount of months, and this stage in this amount of months, et cetera, et cetera. And there are so many things within that timeline that can push you back, whether it's just availability of a certain type of material or availability to talk to this one researcher who's now tied up in this project that one took longer to do. So I understand that there's some things that are beyond, you know, your control. However, I find sometimes that the thought that we can get this done in this amount of time, you got to be realistic on what you're going to get. So you might be able to execute that, but are you really going to get the data that you need? Are you really going to be able to find the people? Are you going to have to make more concessions than it's worth? And you might have to push for more time. Especially in the development, if it's like a new product, you got to get your prototype out, and it needs to get past all of these different layers of validation and approvals. And people push up against that timeline quite often. And that can be our serious detriment to getting the quality data you need. And so I think, I don't say that's necessarily wrong, but I think sometimes you just need to, people need to make concessions and understand like what that means as far as who they're recruiting and the kind of data that they're going to get.
No, that's true. It reminds me of the anecdote, like good, faster, cheap, like pick two, right? You can't have all three of those. So which two do you want? And it's very difficult to get all three. So
you can't get all three. It applies to all industries for sure.
Awesome. So as we start to wrap up here, what is one piece of advice that you can give someone looking to improve their approach to research, or just advice in the research industry in general?
Well, I'm sure you've seen a theme here, which is human connection. And that's what I'm very passionate about. And I think the most that you could spend trying to broaden your perspective in general, and this is just, I mean, this applies to research, this applies to life itself, but I think it really does apply to research. The more you can look into how other people live, how other people feel, and what affects that in just daily life, the more open your brain is going to be to executing decent research. And that goes from understanding your neighbor down the street to maybe reading a book about a whole different like population of people than you never, ever will ever come across in your life, because perspectives are really going to deepen your connection with that human. Just humanity as a whole. And I just think that I'm very passionate about that. And I think that just makes us more well-rounded individuals in this society, as well as provides really great research and a really great basis for finding, getting those key nuggets of truth out of the research that you're conducting.
Deanna, that's good. Especially, I think in this day and age, let's not forget humanity in the age of AI and digital and devices and everything. Like, it still is that human to human connection, as we all learned during COVID. Like, there was no secret there that people were yearning for that connection. So that's really good.
Well, and I also think I'd like to caution against, we have so many things now that are like AI fraud detection, right? Oh, this was written by AI. I can tell that this text is 70% AI. Well, the way that we're communicating as humans has changed. Mm-hmm. I use Grammarly on a pretty regular basis. I'm way wordy. I could write like paragraphs of emails, and I recognize that that scares people. So I will ask Grammarly to say, hey, can you make this more concise and clear? Yeah. But that's genuine. That's a genuine communication. That's me, but I'm using an AI tool. You're using an AI tool to detect someone being AI. That's a genuine answer from you. Yeah, so you have to start thinking too about, we are kind of combining technology and humanity in the way that we communicate. So it's not as cut and dry. I mean, I know it's kind of a tangent here, but that's like a huge thing in the research and academic space right now. People that are well-versed in writing are actually getting their stuff flagged as AI when it's entirely, purely genuine. And it's sad. It's just because they're really good writers.
Yeah.
Taught how to write, you know?
Yeah. Talk
about, oh, the M dash is like a clear sign of an AI. Well, one of the leaders on my team, Sandy Clear, she went to technical writing school. She was taught quite like that.
Yeah.
Stuff's going to get flagged all the time.
I know.
You use Grammarly. Like another one, my colleague, it's so funny. She uses Grammarly and she always says, when we're on the same page, make sure we're on the same page. And Grammarly is always like, no, say aligned, say aligned, say aligned.
No.
So now he never says I'm on the same page. He always says, make sure that we're aligned. So AI is actually teaching us how to speak more like AI.
Yeah, no, it's so true.
Like diving into that identity is also just acknowledging that we are affected and we are influenced by the technology we use. And that's just a part of culture changing. And it's not a bad thing, but we do need, again, to, as humans, kind of take a look at that and realize like that's what it is now.
Yeah, yeah. And it's funny you mentioned the M dash. Like the M dash has gotten like a really bad rap of like, hey, this is AI. Because to your point, I was talking to a professor. And she's like, I know how to write. And I was using the M way before AI was using the M dash. So it is true that like that's a flag, but people really know how to use it. Now they're cautious not to use it. So it's like, what do you do? So
it requires a lot more work now. If you're a student, you have to like rewrite your things over and over again.
Yeah.
Insert some colloquialisms to make it be like, I'm real.
Yeah. I'm actually very thankful that like generative AI wasn't around when I was a student, because I know I would like push the limits. I know I would. So, oh, awesome. Hey, Mary, this has been a ton of fun. If listeners want to connect with you, learn more about your work, what you're doing, where should they go?
Sure. So if you go to our website, www.leresearch.com, we've got a meet the team section where you can go through and see everyone who's doing all of the great work at our company. There's also a really awesome product insights section of the website explaining exactly what our department does and how we connect with your research and be that connective tissue, like I mentioned before. But yeah, you can always find us there. And of course, good old LinkedIn.
Yeah. LinkedIn's always a good source. Well, hey, Mary, thanks so much for coming on again. And listeners, thank you so much for listening. If you've made it this far, you need to subscribe, follow, reach out, like, you know, because you are the real ones here. And we want to make sure that this podcast gets out to a lot of people. So make sure you used to share it if you found anything valuable. And yeah, Mary, thanks so much for joining and looking forward to catching up.
Thank you. This was fun.
All right. Thanks, y'all.